Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording of the sermon from our Valentine's Day service. Carolyn Letier's sermon is entitled, What is This Thing Called Love? Her sermon will be followed by additional remarks by Reverend Bodie. Thanks for listening.
Picture this. It is 1955. I'm 11 years old. I'm sitting all by myself in the dining room, playing a 45 record on the family stereo. It is the dreamy crooning of Perry Como singing, You'll Always Be My Lifetime Sweetheart.
You'll always be my lifetime sweetheart. Never have I loved this way.
I know that when you kiss me, years from now, you'll kiss me as you did today.
In my hands, I'm holding a glossy 8x10 photo. It's our class picture, some 30 kids lined up in rows, but my eyes are zeroing in on one blurry face, a boy. I gaze lovingly at the boy's face, and I listen to Perry Como, and I may be mixing up Perry Como with a boy with whom I've never actually exchanged a word, but it doesn't matter. I'm in love. I love with no hope. I love for the sake of love. This is the purest and by far the least complicated love I will ever know. At 11, I've already been schooled in love by fairy tales, Cinderella, Girl Saved from Abusive Family by Handsome Prince, Snow White, Girl Saved from Poison Apple-Induced Coma by Handsome Prince, Sleeping Beauty, Girl Saved from Spinning Wheel Prick-Induced Coma by Handsome Prince. The love of a handsome prince was the key to salvation. Any fool could see that. So on this Valentine's Day, I want to talk to you about love, romantic love. I've been interested in it since I was 11. I've sought it, I've got it, and I've lost it more times than once. Early on, after my first handsome prince, I learned that love is not necessarily all hearts and flowers. It can lead to pain and misery. It can be clouded with judgment and expectations. It can be confused with hunger for security or control. So I've spent many years puzzling over what it all means. How can something so wonderful turn so bad? How can something so desirable be so elusive? Is love something you feel or something you do? What is this thing called love? Well, I've done plenty of searching and researching, and so today I want to share with you what I've learned so far, talking about three different theories about what is this thing called love. First, love is a social construction. At the university, I learned that love is a belief system manufactured by culture in order to fulfill certain social needs. The theory is that romantic love began in the high Middle Ages between noble as courtly love, between noble knights and ladies. Now, this was a time of transition between the hierarchical fixed structure of the Middle Ages and a looser, more open time that would be the Renaissance. Up until this time, marriage had been arranged agreements based on economics or politics. Then a new notion of an exciting new kind of love was born. In courtly love, a single man would pay court to a married lady. He would worship the lady in a high, lofty, poetic manner. This was theoretically, love was supposed to be theoretically unconsummated platonic love. The lady was supposed to be like an angel, inspiring the man to noble deeds and bringing him closer to God. Now, in our context, we would call it an extramarital affair, or at least a flirtation. But in that rarefied context, it was something grand and beautiful. For the first time, love could lead to salvation. But this new thing, romantic love, did not stay in the spiritual realm. Once Western culture had invented it, it took on a life of its own, changing through the centuries, fulfilling different needs, and changing its understanding of what it actually meant. So when I think about my own life, and I wonder if this theory applies to me, I think it's true that the fairy tales that I was read can be seen as remnants of this high ideal of love is salvation. And I do believe it's true that our expectations around romantic love are culturally constructed. Growing up in the 1950s, I was schooled to believe that love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage. I don't think I ever had a romance, even up through my adulthood, when I didn't dream or hope that somehow it would lead to that long-term, bigger kind of love. When that enchanted feeling started waning, either on his part or on mine, what I felt was something between disappointment and tragedy. And I asked myself, why isn't this thing working? What am I doing wrong? Still, is love nothing more than a bunch of socially constructed expectations? Here's a different theory, theory number two, that says it's a lot more fundamental than that. According to some scientists who study the intersection between behavior and neurology, romantic love is a biologically based behavior that originated some 3.5 million years ago among early hominids and also exists in some mammals and birds. In other words, romantic love is animal. It's hardwired in us. It's what biological anthropologist Helen Fisher calls a biological motivation system. According to Fisher, love is not the same thing as this, romantic love is not the same thing as the sex drive. Romantic love is part of a, there are three different ones of these biological motivation systems that are involved in reproduction. The first is romantic love, the second is a sex drive, and the third is attachment. All three of these systems light up different parts of the brain and involve different brain chemicals. The goal of romantic love is attraction, bringing two people together in a very cozy way to give the sex drive a chance to do its thing. On a biological level, the brain chemical dopamine floods the brain when you fall in love. Dopamine stimulates the reward and pleasure centers. Because of this neurohormone reward, romantic love can become addictive, with all the cravings, the rush, and the withdrawal symptoms characteristic of addiction. Or, in the words of Johnny Cash, love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring.
I fell into a burning ring of fire, went down, 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 and the flames went higher, and it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire, and it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Can love last? Between 12 and 18 months, according to this science. Romantic love is metabolically expensive. It just uses up too many of the body's resources. Biological mechanisms can only stand this intensity for so long. So, does this seem true to my own life? Romantic love as an intoxicating biological response. Well, from my experience, all I can say is amen to that. Romantic love is one of the greatest thrills on earth. And the dopamine rush helps explain that overpowering addictive quality, the longings, the looking for an excuse to mention his name, the little thrill you get pronouncing it, the restless waiting for his phone call, the tragic withdrawals when someone breaks your heart. But all those symptoms might have a more nuanced explanation than just the firing of brain cells. So here's a third theory, a psychological way of looking at love. Now, you've all heard the expression, love is blind, attributed variously to Plato, to Chaucer, to Shakespeare, and to J. Mason Brewer, who wrote those famous lines, I don't make love by the garden gate because love is blind, but the neighbors ain't. Why does romantic love blind us to the faults of our beloved? Well, Jungian psychologists say that when we fall in love, what we are seeking is union with the divine. We want a lover who is a beloved, who is not like no other, who will carry us to everlasting joy, who will keep us safe, who will always understand us. In other words, we're looking for a God. We project this God image onto the beloved. He or she is larger than life, sweeter than honey, supernaturally wonderful. The beloved is seen in all his or her imagined perfection. As the writer Stendhal said, before you love, you see the other person as a bare branch. As you fall, you coat him or her in jeweled attractions, 80% of your own making. In this bejeweled glamour, we believe that person to be the one who will complete us, who will be the perfect opposite, who will make us whole. Now, I can see some of this pattern in my own life, and I'll give you an example. In my 30s, I was a single working mother with two children. I was not one of those unfortunate women who just can barely survive. My kids were in elementary and middle school. I had a good, if not exciting, job. We had a good life, but I was tied down, and all my energy went into supporting and taking care of my children. I loved being a mother, and I felt like a hero doing it by myself, but that did not change the fact that my life was all about being responsible. So at that time, I fell in love with a traveling man. This is a man who lived out of his van. He had a wood stove inside, a little shake roof on top with a chimney. He was exotic to me. He was the opposite of tied down. He had no schedules. He had no obligations. He was free. I fell madly in love with this person. It was a huge, irrational passion with dramatic ups and downs, doomed, of course, to failure. When I think back, it seems obvious to me that he was living the parts of my life that I had completely denied. He could be free. He could be self-centered. He could get up and go when he felt like it. In a strange and compelling way, he was my missing half. Problem is, you can't expect another person to live your life for you. I didn't need someone to live like that. I needed to live a whole and complete life myself. It was too much for him. If my life had been a musical comedy, when he walked out the door, he would have been singing these Bob Dylan lyrics.
You say you're looking for someone who's never weak but always strong, to protect you and defend you, whether you are right or wrong. Someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe.
This blind projection-based love can help explain why people get so furious with their beloved. When the projection fades, as it must in time, you can become so disappointed, so disillusioned, that you feel betrayed. I remember clearly when this man left, I felt like I'd been ripped in half. I felt like he'd done me wrong. But I also remember looking in the bathroom mirror at my blubbery, tear-stained face and knowing in my heart of hearts it was a good thing he'd gone. Now that I'm a grandma and a veteran of a first marriage, almost 30 years into a second, I want to reach out to that little 11-year-old girl that I was, take her hand and say to her, yes, handsome princes are great, and yes, romantic love is the most marvelous thing, but it's also true that loving another person can be challenging. Back in the 1950s, I was schooled to believe that the only legitimate basis for a marriage was a passionate romantic love. Anything else, like, say, friendship or a good working partnership, was considered a marriage of convenience, and it was unfulfilling and a compromise of the true self. With these expectations, it took me a long time to figure out that marital love is not the same animal as romantic love. It is love, but it's not always romantic and it's not always thrilling. My parents did not have a particularly happy love or happy marriage, I have no idea how their love was. So with no example to follow, I've had to learn the hard way, although I think a lot of people have to learn the hard way. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's had this struggle. I don't intend to speak in any depth about this other kind of love, long-term love, but I do want to mention a couple things that I have found that are ways to convert out of romantic love, to let it go, to open your heart for something else. First, try a different neurochemical hormone. Once the dopamine runs out, there's always plenty of oxytocin to be had. Oxytocin is the neurohormone that makes you want to hold and treasure somebody. It's known as the cuddle hormone. It's the thing that when you're sitting at the breakfast table, looking at your frowsy-headed mate sitting there with sleep in his eyes, makes you think, oh, isn't he sweet? Number two, kindness. Many of you remember Carl Nomura, a beloved QUF member, now deceased. And I think I can talk about his story because he spoke of it openly and even once gave a sermon here about it. Carl and his wife, Louise, were strong, wonderful people who had a creative but sometimes stormy marriage for many years. When they were about my age, I think, they suddenly had a brainstorm. Be kind to each other. Simple acts of kindness every day without making a big deal about it and without hinting around for credit. This changed the tenor of their life together, and they had a happy marriage the last year of their life before Louise died. Besides kindness, the most important thing that I have found is to slow down and pay attention, to really look with an open heart at that person sitting across from me at the breakfast table. Forget about the God image. Forget about that handsome prince. That's all projection and cultural conditioning. The true thing is the human being in front of me. Oddly enough, once I let go of who I thought he was or who I thought he should be and just slow down and look at who he actually is, he surprises me. It's as if by letting go of the grip of these projections, I allow him to be more himself, or at least I'm able to see him as he is. I see him as a human man, a product of nature's generosity. I see the mystery of life within him. And this touches me deeply. Seeing him and knowing him in this way opens my heart. It changes me. It brings me to love. Thank you.
what is this thing called love? One of the reasons we have to raise this question is because our English word love is asked to carry so much freight, to cover so much territory. In English, we don't distinguish, as other languages do, between different types of love or the unique qualities of our different love connections. Greek, for example, has four words, eros, philia, storge, and agape, sexual passion, friendship, affection in families, and brotherly concern, all of which in our English language we translate by the word love. In Sanskrit, I've read that there are 96 different words differentiating and distinguishing the unique qualities of the particular connections and relationships that we have. But for us English speakers, apparently, love is all you need, which can be a bit confusing and which one might send one on a voyage of discovery, such as Carolyn has delightfully shared with us on this Valentine's Day. And indeed, in our time, it is the romantic love of Valentine's Day that attracts most of the attention. My friend, author Robert Johnson, suggests that a primary reason for the importance of romantic love in our time is that it's in romantic love that modern people find religious experience. He means by that an ecstatic encounter with the other, with the divine, with the holy, with powers that transcend and transform the ego and shake it to its very core. I've had conversations with Robert Johnson in which he says that in India, he has witnessed persons in Hindu temples trembling in ecstasy before the image of a god or a goddess. But now, he says, these deities have largely left the temples so that the images of God in both male and female forms are no longer sought or found in the temples. But in our time, the images of the divine are sought and found on the faces of ordinary men and women in everyday life. And so romantic love is our secular age's religious experience. Persons who would have nothing to do with religion of any kind or have any thoughts beyond the horizontal material world are seized by powers beyond themselves that manifest in the form of romantic love. There can be a problem with this, however, as Carolyn has shared with us, namely, that finite, fallible, and fragile human beings are not capable for any length of time of holding the divine image or of carrying so much ecstatic energy. I loved Carolyn's quip about romantic love being metabolically expensive. You simply can't live at that level for very long. It burns you up. But we try to bring this religious, ecstatic experience of romantic love into marriage. We try to integrate romantic love and marital love, making romantic love not only the entry point for marriage, but also often the basis for marriage. And that is a real problem, for again, as Robert Johnson points out, romantic love and marital love are two very different kinds of love, involving two very different systems whose interests and priorities are exactly in reverse order. The order of interests and priorities in romantic love is as follows. First, the ego and its completion, fulfillment, and passion. Secondly, the other person, whom you need as a vehicle in order to complete yourself. And then thirdly, the relationship, which you can and probably should dissolve if it no longer serves to complete and fulfill your ego needs. On the other hand, in marriage, as traditionally conceived, that is, as a lifetime, lifelong commitment and relationship, in marriage, the order is the exact opposite. First, it's the relationship that's first of importance, the relationship that each person serves and that holds fast through good and ill. Secondly, it's the other person, your partner, whom you care for through thick and thin. And then thirdly, it's yourself, for you have to maintain your individuality and integrity as a human being, both to care for the well-being of your partner and to serve the relationship. The journey that Carolyn has shared with us this morning, as I see it, is a grappling between these two very different types of love and a journey of discovery in which the love at the end of her journey is of a very different nature and quality than the love at the beginning. A shift, as Carolyn has described it, from romantic love to long-term love, or again, a movement from falling in love and being in love to being loving and practicing loving kindness. A shift from having one's eyes blinded by love to having one's eyes opened to love and for love. And a shift of focus from the I to the thou, from the ecstasy of the ego being struck and captured by the divine, to the joy of the ego in serving the divine and appreciating the divine in all its manifold forms. This, following Robert Johnson's lead, is religious experience that can work on an ongoing basis, that is to say, where we are awakened to the miracle of the everyday and ordinary, as Carolyn described at the end. And in the end, I think we can thank and appreciate romantic love. It's the training ground that awakens us to the glory, beauty, and wonder of life. Because indeed, in romantic love, one does encounter a golden world. One gets blasted by an energy bolt from heaven. And it's a true vision. It's a true world. It just can't sustain itself. And it takes a while, as Carolyn has indicated, to fully discover that heaven on earth. But wondrously, miraculously, it can be done. So may it be.